It is my pleasure to introduce to you Wesley Smith, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. He serves as a lawyer and consultant for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, as well as being a special consultant for the Center for Bioethics and Culture. He is well known for his blog, Secondhand Smoke, which advances his theory of human exceptionalism and criticizes individuals whom he has termed mainstream bioethicists, such as Peter Singer. Smith has also authored or co-authored 12 books and has been published in The New York Times, Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and many other national news outlets. His topic, eugenics and the danger of undignified bioethics.
Morning. Thank you, Molly, for having me here. Thank you, Cleveland Right to Life. It's interesting to be on the same stage as Gordon. You know, I think I've just found the solution to our energy crisis. Plug him in, and we'll have lights throughout the country. And no, although there would be some carbon emissions, I guess. I don't know. I'm from California. It's always great when I'm invited to come to the Sun Belt. There was this stuff on the ground last night when I was walking, and it tried to make me fall down. What is this? And thank you all for coming out on a looked like a beautiful, I'm sure cold, but sunny day today. And I also like you all to give yourselves a round of applause for caring about something bigger than yourselves. One of the things I've been struck with lately is that it's really impossible these days to actually have debates, because a debate assumes a commonality of value system or a commonality of reference. And so you might have a common goal in mind, but differences over means on how to achieve the common end. I don't think we have that anymore in this society. And I think when I get deeper into my presentation and as you go forward with this convention, I think we have to come to the realization that the values, the morality that everyone in this room just takes as a self-evident truth is rejected. They are rejected by many in our culture. So what does that mean we can do? Well, I don't think we can debate, but I do think we can hold up a particular worldview. And when you hold up that particular worldview, you're able to show this is where this worldview leads, and this is where that worldview leads. And people out there in America and Western civilization, you're going to have to choose. You're going to have to choose which worldview you will follow. And be careful what you ask for, because you just might get it. And so with that in mind, I'd like to talk a little bit today about the worldview that we disagree with which we disagree in this room, or you wouldn't be here today. I got into this work opposing assisted suicide and euthanasia in 1993. And since that time, I'd been asking myself, why now? Why now, when we can actually alleviate so much pain? Pastor, I'm sure your wife got some really good pain control and had her pain, the pain of a broken hip, alleviated so she could rest and begin to heal. Why now are we talking about, quote, death with dignity, as if dying naturally isn't dignified? As if my dad, who went to hospice when he died from cancer, was a chump or something instead of taking poison pills? Why now, when we can do so much to make sure people don't die in agony, are we talking about euthanasia, when 100 years ago, when people did die in agony, where if your appendix burst — I was on the plane coming out here, a woman was telling me she had a burst appendix while she was visiting San Francisco. Well, she was flying home and in good health. 100 years ago, she would have died in agony. If you got bone cancer 100 years ago, you died in agony. And no one was talking about euthanasia, assisted suicide, 100 years ago. In fact, in the late 1800s, euthanasia meant a good death, which meant dying in grace, in peace, surrounded by your family. And that very proper word was co-opted by the nascent what is now called the euthanasia movement, to mean mercy killing. So why now? of all times are we going into this? And then I read a book by a fellow named Levin, Yuval Levin. Yuval Levin is a protege of Leon Cass. I don't know if any of you have heard of Leon Cass. He's a wonderful bioethicist of the Human Dignity School. He was the head of President Bush's Council on Bioethics, did tremendous work. And Yuval Levin wrote a book called Imagining the Future. And it's about the stem cell issue, which we really won't get into, at least in my presentation today. But he wrote something that was kind of like, oh, I should have had a V8 moment, because it made me understand the why now question. And here's what he wrote. He said, he talked about Descartes, and he said, Descartes described health as, quote, without doubt the primary good and the foundation of all other goods of this life, close quote. And that, he starts to write, any societies of the foundational good necessarily give shape to its politics. That's true. Its social institutions, its sense of moral purpose and direction, which is actually what this convention is all about, trying to create those kinds of purposes for society. And he writes, and health is an unusual candidate for the primary good. It is surely an essential good. Without health, not much else can be enjoyed. But Descartes' formulation in the worldview of modern science, and this is really crucial, sees health not only as a foundation, but also a principal goal. Not only as a beginning, but also an end. Relief and preservation from disease and pain, from misery and necessity, become the defining ends of human action and therefore of human society. What he's saying is that society's purpose has shifted. It's shifted from promoting righteousness. It's shifted from protecting the lives of all its citizens, and it's become the elimination of suffering. And if the purpose, the very goal of society is to eliminate suffering, how quickly that metastasizes into eliminating the sufferer. That's what you see happening around you and all of the issues with which you engage. And in fact, the very concept of suffering itself becomes very elastic. Let me give you an example from my own life. My uncle Bruno died of Alzheimer's disease. My uncle Bruno suffered during that very difficult experience. So did my Aunt Martha, his wife. In fact, my Aunt Martha, excuse me, was so concerned and upset when we finally had to put Uncle Bruno into the Alzheimer's unit. She was running to go take care of him, and she fell down the stairs and broke her hip. My mother suffered watching this. My mother's father died when she was five in 1922. Uncle Bruno, her older brother, was the rock of her life. He had taken over that role as she was growing up. He had been her protector. And so for my mother's whole life, and when my uncle died, my mother, who's now 97, was in her late 80s. And she watched as that rock of her life, was the one memory she had going back to the beginning, faded away. She suffered. So did my cousin, their daughter. I suffered watching all of this. So did the medical personnel who cared so beautifully for these people. It's very difficult to go into an Alzheimer's unit and see elderly people wandering or clutching a teddy bear and so forth. They suffered. And in fact, in bioethics today, you'll hear about how people such as my uncle shouldn't have to be cared for because of the suffering it causes to healthcare professionals. And some would even say society suffered because of the cost of care, of taking care of my uncle and people like him. And you're now beginning to see talk of death panels. Why did that term that Sarah Palin used so effectively in terms of political rhetoric, why did it resonate? Because people know there's a strong element of truth to it. And good political rhetoric defines the debate, and the death panel attack that she made has actually defined quite a bit about where our current healthcare system is leading. And you actually now see arguments in the New York Times and other places. We need death panels. How dare she call them death panels? But we need death panels. So when you begin to understand, or when I began to understand, wait a minute, this is all about eliminating suffering. And the flip side of that is enabling what I want. We become an I want culture. Then it all becomes logical, and all of the things that seem to be disparate begin to fall into place as a logical consistency. So next time you're out and you're discussing these issues with people, realize it's no longer about righteousness. It's no longer about protecting human life. It is about making sure people either do not experience difficulty and suffering, or the converse of that, they get what they want because it makes them feel good. And that is a different worldview than the one you hold, which deals with principles and righteousness and right and wrong and values and so forth. And all you can do is hold up two different worldviews and say, one leads to one place and one leads to another. One leads to elderly people like my Uncle Bruno being valued, and one does not. One leads to millions of abortions, and one does not. And people are going to have to decide in our society which path they will follow. And that means, I think, it is incumbent upon those who wish to be deeply involved in these issues to be aware of what's going on around them. It means engaging things that are very painful, as you're all going to experience this weekend. And I think it means, and this can be hard for pro-lifers, expanding beyond the abortion issue. People need to become as deeply principally engaged helping the elderly woman in the nursing home and the man dying of AIDS as they are unborn babies. Because it's about a lot more than abortion now, which means more work, more effort, more commitment, but it's also, if I might say, more important. Not that the other wasn't, but there's just so much more to it now. So what do I mean when I talk about a undignified bioethics? I always, when I speak, I like to bring my footnotes. Basically, what I try to do is demonstrate my thesis with what people with a different worldview are actually saying in writing. And it's real tempting for people who don't hold that worldview to say, oh, they can't really mean that. Or, oh, ho, ho, what will they think of next? And rolling the eyes, it can't happen here. Let me just say this about the it can't happen here. That is a prescription for utter defeat. It is a complacency that is not warranted. Anyone who says it can't happen here has been asleep for the last 50 years. Not only can it happen here, it is happening here. And it is happening now, and it is planned to get worse as things go along. So this idea of an undignified bioethics, human exceptionalism means that there is intrinsic human dignity that just comes with the package of being human. We do not have to earn our rights. We should not have to earn our love. It should come as part of the package of being human. And there's another part of that. People say, well, why don't you just talk about the sanctity and equality of human life? Well, I do talk about that, but that's not the whole thing. Human exceptionalism also means that we have duties. We are the only duties-bearing species in the known universe. We have duties to ourselves. We have duties to each other. We have duties to our posterity. The founders of this great country were writing and discussing their posterity all the time. That's us. And what you are doing here is hopefully preparing a better society for those who will come after us. We have duties to those who aren't even born yet, our posterity. We have duties to animals, to treat them humanely. A rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy, which means there's an equality between all animals and humans. I didn't coin that. I stole it. I stole it from Ingrid Newkirk, the head of the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, who says a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy, because she means it. She means that there's no distinction between a monkey and a human being. Did you know that an orangutan in Brazil has been given a writ of habeas corpus and declared a person? That is incredibly destructive of the human value of human life. There have been lawsuits filed in this country to that same effect with chimpanzees. A river in New Zealand was declared a person and given legal rights. We have duties to the environment, yes. We can protect the environment. Look at Yellowstone. We protected Yellowstone without naming Old Faithful Geyser a person. There's a purpose to this. It is anti-human. It is to denigrate us. It is to reduce us to just another animal in the forest. Because once you take human exceptionalism away, then we can do anything we like to each other. In the name of compassion. It's not compassion, it's abandonment. It's not love, it's cruelty. It involves killing. And that comes about because we are being dehumanized. The importance of human life is being destroyed. And we must uplift it. And we must say, no, we are not just another animal in the forest. We are the exceptional species. We are the moral species. We do not cause suffering. We're the only species that mitigates suffering. I'm about to go into a different speech, so I'm hauling myself back into this concept of undignified bioethics. Now, when I talk about undignified bioethics, I'm not coining that term. It's the title of an article written by a fellow named Alastair Cochrane from the UK in the journal Bioethics, December 2009. If you want to see what's going wrong in the culture or what will go wrong, read the professional journals, which is what I do. Most people are not aware of what's being written in the various professional and medical journals, the political journals, the academic journals, and the media doesn't cover it. But what appears in those journals ends up becoming part of public policy. For example, in the 1980s, what was appearing in the journal is that somebody like Terry Schiavo, what should we do about them? And the answer in these professional journals was taking away their food and water so they die by dehydration. And people back in the 80s were saying, oh, that will never happen here. Well, it now happens in all 50 states to people who are conscious and unconscious alike. And I bring that up because what is discussed today in the professional journals often becomes public policy and can even become routine, as has occurred with that food and fluids issue. Now, of course, we need to have bioethics, which is biomedical ethics. That is, we have to have the ethics and morality of healthcare, not only in terms of at the bedside, but also in terms of our public policy. If you support bioethics, which would support human exceptionalism, then we're going to analyze these various issues that come up, and some of them are very difficult, from the point of view of the sanctity and dignity and value of human life. But if you say human life does not have intrinsic dignity, you're going to look at things another way. And if it says, well, how do we eliminate suffering? Well, pretty soon you're eliminating the sufferer. So this fellow writes this article called Support of Undignified Bioethics. And what struck me so strongly when I read this was how powerful a case he makes for a dignified bioethics. Let me read some of it to you. First, he talked about dignity as a form of behavior. So that, there's such a thing as acting in an undignified way, right, Gordon? The Three Stooges, right? Woo, woo, woo. Rah, rah, rah. They're not acting in a dignified way. Hey, oh, woo, woo. But that's that's not what he's talking about. Or the way I act when my wife says, Wesley, you know. So let's move away from the idea of acting in an undignified manner into what we're really talking about. And here's what Cochrane wrote. The second important conception of dignity that we need to consider does not see dignity as a form of behavior, but as a property. Under this conception, the possession of dignity by humans signifies they have an inherent moral worth. Yes. In other words, because human beings possess dignity, we cannot do what we like to them. Exactly. But instead have direct moral obligations toward them. How could anybody turn this away? But they do. He goes on, indeed, this understanding of dignity is also usually considered to serve as the grounding for human rights. Absolutely. Without human exceptionalism, you do not have human rights. Because to have human rights, universal human rights, being human is what gives you the rights. if being human, an objective standard, isn't what gives you rights, then our who has rights and who doesn't have rights becomes subjective. And once they're subjective, who has the power to decide determines who has the rights and who has the burdens, who gets their life protected and who gets killed. This is crucial to understand. It is the foundation of everything Western civilization is about. The unique dignity of human beings creates universal human rights, which also creates opportunity and the prosperity that we've enjoyed in the West, which is unprecedented in human history. It all flows from this. Indeed, this understanding of dignity is usually considered to serve as the grounding for human rights. As Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. So you begin to see the stakes in this worldview contest. A belief in human exceptionalism or dignified bioethics versus an undignified bioethics where human beings do not have intrinsic value, where human exceptionalism is considered a fiction, and where religion is considered a mere superstition to be laughed at and denigrated. He goes on, the conception of dignity as inherent moral worth certainly seems coherent enough as an idea. Yeah. Indeed, we can see why this conception of dignity is employed in certain debates around bioethics. For if all individual human beings possess dignity, then they should not be viewed simply as resources that we can treat however we please. To take an example, then, it may be that we could achieve rapid and significant progress in medical science if we were to conduct wide-ranging medical experiments on groups of human beings. However, because human beings have dignity, so it is argued, that means that they possess a particular quality that grounds certain moral obligations and rights. You're going to be hearing about Holocaust this weekend, I understand. In Auschwitz, which I visited, one of the most horrific experiences of my life, walking where that horror occurred, they did the very kind of immoral experiments he's addressing against Jews because they had redefined Jews from being equal human beings into something less. And once you do that, that means you can start using other human beings in an objective way. Instead of treating them as objects, you treat them as subjects. I'm sorry, instead of treating them as subjects, you treat them as objects. Now, you would think after writing so beautifully and eloquently and articulately in defense of a dignified bioethics, Cochrane would say, that's the way we got to go. No, because he doesn't want to go there. He turns now to saying this. If all human beings possess dignity, this extraordinary moral worth, we need some explanation of what it is about the species Homo sapiens that makes them so deserving. When we start looking at particular characteristics that might ground dignity, language use, moral action, sociality, sentience, self-consciousness, and so on, we soon see that none of these qualities are in fact possessed by each and every human. We are therefore left wondering why all human beings actually do possess dignity. I call this the game of the philosopher and the dupe. So the philosopher will say to you, well, what is it about human beings that makes them unique? Many people, and probably all people in this room, would say, well, only we have a soul. We're made in the likeness and image of God. The philosopher says, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in a soul. Now what do you got for me? And you all know that will happen. Say, fine. Only human beings are moral agents, meaning only we are capable of creating a right and a wrong. And there's no question that that's true. Only human beings create ethical codes, and we do this through a process of rational investigation, rational discussion, our emotions, our experience, and so forth. And so then the philosopher says, okay, I will agree that only human beings are moral beings, and only we are moral agents. But not every human being is a moral agent. An infant in the womb is not a moral agent. The infant doesn't have that capacity. Somebody like Terry Schiavo is no longer a moral agent, or Uncle Bruno, because they've lost those capacities. Therefore, how can you say moral agency is something that grounds human dignity? And the answer is because moral agency is inherent in each and every one of us. It is part of the human condition. We do not measure individual by individual by individual, because when you start measuring individual by individual by individual, none of us is safe, because it means our safety depends on our status of the moment. And as pastor's wife found out, our status of the moment can change like in a snap. And if that's going to be the case, we're only going to be as safe as those attributes we happen to be able to express. But if you look at moral agency, all human beings have it. And if they don't express it, it's either because they are at this point in time either too immature or because of an illness or injury they have lost it. But it is still part of human nature. It is still part of the essence of being human. All human beings will express a morality. Often it's a terrible morality, but it is a morality nonetheless. And so when somebody like Cochrane says, yes, but not every individual possesses that, he is trying to move us away from human exceptionalism, the sanctity of all human life, simply and merely because it's human, to a measurement of individuals, comparing and contrasting, setting the criteria that will be valued and those that will not be valued. And of course, once you start doing that, as I mentioned before, it's who has the power to decide that determines who has value and who doesn't. And that's the end of human equality. That's the end of human liberty. And that's how tyranny happens. And a medicalized tyranny, which we are in danger of, would certainly arise out of this kind of thinking. He goes on, given the controversies over abortion, stem cell research, genetic interventions, animal experimentation, euthanasia, and so on, bioethics does need to engage in debates over whether entities possess entities, by the way. They want the same judgment, whether it's me, a dog, a redwood tree, and so forth. That we cannot have distinctions based on species. That's known in bioethics and animal rights as speciesism. How many of you have heard the term speciesism? That is deemed to be as odious as racism. And it is really a powerful idea in animal rights advocacy, environmental advocacy today, and in bioethics, that you cannot look at a human and an animal and treat a human differently simply because the human is human. That is speciesism, and it is. I've had bioethicists shaking in rage at me for standing against that idea. But he goes on, does need to engage in debates over which entities possess moral worth and why, but these are best conducted by using the notion of moral status and arguing over the characteristics that warrant possession of it. Simply stipulating that all and only human beings possess this inherent moral worth because they have dignity is arbitrary and unhelpful. Yeah, it's unhelpful if you want to be able to kill the weak. It is unhelpful if you want to be able to harvest people like Terry Schiavo's organs, which is being advocated all the time now in medical journals and bioethical journals. It is unhelpful if you want to be able to abort tens of millions of babies at will. Yes, it's very unhelpful. And that's why we want to stand for a dignified bioethics. And then he goes on to say, I urge for an undignified bioethics because what this particular advocate wants is the worldview that we in this room oppose. But this is the worldview that many of the ruling elite accept. This is the worldview you're beginning to see taught in medical schools and nursing schools, in our highest universities where the business leaders of tomorrow, the political leaders of tomorrow are gaining their formation. And it is the worldview that people have to understand exists, that everybody doesn't think about the sanctity of human life the way people in this room do. And you can't go out and say, look, I proved that the unborn child is human, because eventually if you get them to accept that, they'll say, so what? And then what are you going to do? You're going to have to be able to engage these arguments further. You might not be able to change the mind of the person who says, so what? But you can say to the person sitting on the fence, they're saying, so what? Is that what you think? And people can say, well, no. Well, then maybe you need to start thinking and engaging these issues. And look where our view takes us. It leads to liberty. It leads to prosperity. It leads to equality. It leads to protecting the weak and vulnerable. It leads to mitigating suffering, which is a human duty. But it's not utopian. It doesn't promise that which can't be done. It doesn't say that the ends justify the means. And I believe, maybe not in the teaching rooms of Harvard, But on Main Street, we can prevail on this issue because the people are good and decent. And they're not so caught up in their big brains that they've lost the concept of the importance of human life. So what are some of these moral concepts that he was discussing? Usually in bioethics, it surrounds what's called being a person. And in this view, there is such a thing as a human person and a human non-person. So what is it that, in animal rights, just to, because you brought up my book, A Rat as Big as a Dog as a Boy, for the animal rights activists, which has to be contrasted, by the way, with animal welfare. Those are not the same thing. Animal rights is an ideology. Animal welfare is a human duty to treat animals humanely. In the animal rights movement, the ability to feel pain is what gives value. So since a cow can feel pain and a human can feel pain, humans and cows are equal. That means cattle ranching is the same thing as slavery. You see how twisted this becomes. In bioethics, it's the concept of person. And that generally revolves around the ideas of our cognitive capacities. So I'm going to again read from some bioethics advocacy so you can see what it is that they're discussing, and they mean this very seriously. They are as dedicated to these ideas as you are to the pro-life concepts. This is their church as much as a priest going or Padre Pio going to church. This is what they believe in, and they give themselves to it wholeheartedly, and they get paid a lot of money, too, to do it. So this is an article that was written in the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal. The Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal is on the Georgetown University campus. It is one of, it's Catholic. It's, it, although the journal per se is not a Catholic journal per se, but it's on a Catholic university campus. If it's in the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal, it is mainstream in thought because this is one of the most prestigious bioethical journals in the world. And this fellow named John Harris, and he's got all of this Sir David Lyon, you know, professor of this and that, all the numbers and letters. He's a big-time bioethicist from the UK. He's very influential in the healthcare rationing of the National Health Service over there and in advocating for utilitarian bioethics. I know that one of your later presenters is going to talk to you about utilitarianism. Pay very close attention to that presentation. And John Harris wrote this in the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal, December 1999, in an article called The Concept of the Person and the Value of Life. Many, if not most, of the problems of healthcare ethics presuppose that we have a view about what sorts of beings as something that we might think of as ultimate moral value. We would say human beings. Of course, that's being rejected. Or if this sounds too apocalyptic, then we certainly need to identify those sorts of individuals who have the highest moral value or importance. Think about that for a second. If Dr. Harris had written, we need to identify the race that has the highest moral value or importance, we would say, that is bigoted, and we would be right. This is the same invidious discrimination, just different victims, and indeed victims less capable of defending themselves. He goes on to say, because ideas lead to consequences, personhood provides a species-neutral way of group speciesism, remember? A species-neutral way of grouping creatures that have lives that would be wrong to end by killing or by letting die. These may include animals, machines, extraterrestrials, gods, angels, and devils. Understand what he's saying is we cannot accept human exceptionalism, the sanctity of human life, objective value of human dignity. We would take Wesley and measure Wesley. We would take Wesley's late dog, Porthos, and measure Porthos. We would take the redwood tree. We would take the fetus. We would take Uncle Bruno. And we would then measure these based on these criteria of personhood to see who was a person and what wasn't a person. And these criteria have to do with the ability to enjoy one's own life, the ability to value life, being self-aware over time, these kinds of things that I don't have time to get into in detail today. So if you have these capacities at the moment, because remember, they can change in a heartbeat, then if you're able to value your life, if you are self-aware over time, you are a person. And this would include whether you were a human being. If you could demonstrate that an animal was a person, there's a lot of advocacy that dolphins are persons and pigs are persons and parrots are persons. And so forth. Or eventually, if they have an artificial intelligent machine, they're talking about robot rights and things like that. And we all laugh, oh, please, robot rights. They're serious. They're serious. Persons who want to live are wrong by being killed because they are deprived of something they value. In other words, killing isn't wrong. It's only wrong if the person who is killed can value their life, if they're a person. If the entity that is killed is not a person, then that's okay. Persons who do not want to live are not on this account harmed by having their wish to die granted through voluntary euthanasia, for example. I have a two-hour speech to rebut that one sentence. That's the kind of situation we find ourselves in today. Non-persons or potential persons, oh, do you know who a potential person is? A newborn baby. A potential person is a newborn baby who does not yet have these capacities but will develop them. Non-persons, unborn children, Uncle Bruno because they don't have that, Terry Schiavo because they've lost these capacities. Non-persons or potential persons cannot be wronged in this way because death does not deprive them of anything they can value. If they cannot wish to live, they cannot have that wish frustrated by being killed. This is a prescription for killing and getting a good night's sleep. I like to state things bluntly. Get out of this highfalutin language. This is a prescription for killing and getting a good night's sleep. It's also a prescription for harvesting and for treating human beings like corn crops. In another article written in the same Kennedy Institute of Ethics journal by Tom Beauchamp, or Beauchamp, B-E-A-U-C-H-A-M-P, he's notable because he co-authored the most used book in bioethics education called The Principles of Biomedical Ethics. And he wrote, because many humans lack properties of personhood or are less than full persons, they are thereby rendered equal or inferior in moral standing to some non-humans. If this conclusion is defensible, we will need to rethink our traditional view that these unlucky humans cannot be treated in the ways we treat relevantly similar non-humans. For example, they might be used aggressively as human research subjects or sources of organs. You now see the power of ideas, and you now see the consequences of denying intrinsic human dignity. You now see what happens when we say we're not going to accept that being a human is what gives value. We don't have to measure them. We don't have to spindle them. We don't have to fold them. We just have to say, if this is a human being, this human being has certain value. I don't go into personhood. I go into humanhood. Doesn't matter whether we're, quote, a person or not. What matters is that we're human. And the consequences of accepting the idea of one has to earn their value by being a, quote, person are profound. Peter Singer, how many of you have heard of Peter Singer? Most of you, I would assume. Not all, but most. Peter Singer was brought from Monash University in Australia to Princeton because he's because he's the world's foremost proponent of allowing infanticide. Not coincidentally, he's also the person who popularized the animal liberation movement, because these things are all connected. And he wrote in his book, Practical Ethics, which is taught in all university philosophy departments, when the death of a disabled infant will lead to the birth of another infant with better prospects of a happy life, the total amount of happiness will be greater if the disabled infant is killed. Realize he's not even talking about two existing siblings. One is disabled, one isn't. We're going to kill the disabled infant to make sure that the healthier or the able-bodied infant has a better life. He's talking about a disabled infant being born to protect a hypothetical future sibling who might not ever be born. And this is the kind of advocacy that brought him to Princeton, because of it, not in spite of it. He goes on, the loss of a happy life for the first infant is outweighed by the gain of a happier life for the second, which may or may not be born. Therefore, if killing the hemophiliac infant, that's his example, has no adverse effect on others, it would, according to the total view, puffing my pipe, be right to kill him. Please understand, these people are very, very serious about these ideas. Now, you might say, well, okay, infanticide, yes, we have abortion, yes, we even have late-term abortion, but infanticide? In the Netherlands, under the euthanasia program, even though it's not technically legal, according to two studies in The Lancet, which is a medical journal published in the UK, 8% of all infant deaths are caused by doctors killing babies in the Netherlands, 8%. That's not 8% of all infants, but 8% of all infant deaths are caused by doctors giving lethal injections of babies in their cribs. According to this study, 45% of neonatologists have killed babies in the Netherlands, and 31% of pediatricians. Think about that. They even have something called the Groningen Protocol. You can look it up on Google, Groningen. The Groningen Protocol is a bureaucratic checklist that has been published by pediatricians about which, and neonatologists, which babies can be killed and why. And it has to do with what's called the life unworthy, that's German. It's called an unlivable life. That is, if the baby has got a terminal condition or a severe disability, it is because of the suffering, the life is deemed unlivable and the doctor can kill. And by the way, 27%, according to that study, of these infant killings, infanticide, are done without parental consent. Not that a parent should have a right to have their baby killed. So this is already happening in the Netherlands. And you might say, well, but the world will think that's wrong. The Groningen Protocol was published, with all due respect, in the New England Journal of Medicine, the most prestigious medical journal in the world. In Belgium, where they also have legalized euthanasia, they have now opened the door to child-assisted suicide without an age limit. Because these babies are not thought to have intrinsic value, and so we are going to eliminate suffering by eliminating the sufferer. You may remember the afterbirth abortion argument. There was a bioethics journal called the Journal of Medical Ethics, which comes out, of, by the way, out of Oxford University. These are the highest levels of learning. And they wrote an article, I've got it here, Afterbirth Abortion, Why Should the Baby Live? Normally, these kinds of things don't get public attention. This one happened to and created a firestorm, which is what we should all be encouraged, because people got so upset by this idea that it's acceptable to kill a newborn baby because the baby isn't a person. That's why it was all done this way, that they actually took it off the website, because there was such a strong reaction against it. They didn't, and there was one of these non-apology apologies. I'm sorry if you were offended by what I said, not I'm sorry because of what I said. And the idea was, we're just philosophers musing and talking about things. We didn't advocate putting this into policy. Bioethics is about policy. They engage in this discourse because they want to change the law and they want to change the values of society. And in this article, they actually said, quote, being human is not a reason for ascribing someone a right to life. And they were talking about born babies. They were not talking about abortion. And they called it afterbirth abortion. And they said anything that would justify an abortion should justify an afterbirth abortion. And as you know better than I do, anything justifies abortion. So this is being very seriously considered in bioethics advocacy, and part of what I am committed to is saying, okay, hey, everybody, this is what they want, and bringing it to the place where people can see it. And it's kind of like you turn on the lights and the cockroaches scatter, right? I'm not saying they're cockroaches. Their ideas are cockroaches. Planned Parenthood, you may recall, in Florida, there was a committee hearing, and they were, the Planned Parenthood representative lobbyist was asked, if a child is born from an abortion and survives the abortion, should that child be saved? And the answer was, we believe that any decision that that's made should be left up to the woman, her family, and the physician. They got a lot of heck for that, too, and they should have. That's why you have to cast light on this, and you have to show, see what happens when you refuse human dignity? You start saying that a woman doesn't just have the right to an abortion, that she has a right to a dead fetus. And if the fetus, by the way, once the child is outside of the mother, that child, he or she, is no longer a fetus. He or she is a baby. There's no such thing as a born fetus. There's born babies. Fetus is a medical term. An embryo, a fetus, a neonate, it's the same human being from the beginning of the completion of that fertilization process, just different areas of development. I'm the same individual I was when I was an embryo. I just have grayer hair. What about harvesting organs? Remember, we talk about the idea that people could be harvested for their organs. That is being advocated in very prominent medical journals. I hasten to add, unlike infanticide in the Netherlands, it is not being done today in our hospitals, and there are a lot of bioethicists frustrated because it isn't. This is an article in The Lancet. Should organs from patients in permanent vegetative state be used for transplantation? Let me read you the conclusion. If the legal definition of death were to be changed to include comprehensive irreversible loss of higher brain function, it would be possible to take the life of a patient, or more accurately, to stop the heart, since the patient would be defined as dead. This is relativism run amok. The patient wouldn't be dead, but would be defined as dead by a lethal injection and then remove the organs needed for transplantation. They're talking there about allowing people like, and I use Terry Shaver just because it personalizes who we're talking about and the kinds of people we're talking about. It would allow her, instead of being dehydrated to death slowly over 2 weeks, denied food and water so that blood pooled in her eyes, which is what happened to the real Terry Schiavo, just saying, oh my goodness, let's just take her liver. Other people have better uses for it than she does. This is from Critical Care Medicine, article in 2003. Critical Care Medicine is the professional journal for the ICU docs. Role of brain death and the dead donor rule and the ethics of organ transplantation. We propose that these are Harvard doctors. We propose that individuals who desire to donate their organs and who are either neurologically devastated or imminently dying should be allowed to donate their organs without first being declared dead. In Belgium, where euthanasia is legal since 2001, and they basically jumped. The Dutch kind of slipped down that slippery slope. And by the way, it's not alarmism. It's not slippery slope. This is facts on the ground, right? The Belgians jumped headfirst with a smile on their face. And back in 1993, in my first article against assisted suicide, I warned that eventually euthanasia would be coupled with organ harvesting as a plumb to society. And that is exactly what's being done now in Belgium and the Netherlands. Euthanized patients are harvested for their organs. The first, I read in a transplant journal, very respected international transplant journal, the doctors talked about getting the lungs and transplanting the lungs from euthanasia victims. They didn't call them victims, that's my term. And they said the best people to go after in terms of this potential are people with neuromuscular disabilities, people like with multiple sclerosis and mental illnesses. And they do kill mentally ill people in the Netherlands, and they do kill mentally ill people, depressed people in Belgium as part of their euthanasia program. Because remember, if eliminating suffering is the goal, there are a lot of people who suffer far longer and for far more, many more years than the terminally ill. That whole euthanasia movement is not about terminal illness. That's just to get people distracted from the real goal, which is killing is an acceptable answer to human suffering. And once killing is an acceptable answer to human suffering, it doesn't stay with the terminally ill, because a lot of people suffer far more than people with terminal illness, particularly people anguishing for decades with severe mental conditions, illnesses. So they describe these four people who were euthanized. Three had neuromuscular disabilities. One was mentally ill, and when I read what that mental illness was, my head exploded. It was self-harming. So the answer to self-harming was to kill the patient and then harvest the organs. I cannot think of anything more dangerous to a society than for desperate, suffering people to think that their deaths have greater value than their lives? Well, maybe one thing, getting society to think that too. All of this flows from rejecting human exceptionalism, the intrinsic dignity of human life. I am told I have 5 minutes left. I'm a lawyer, come on. So I'm going to move past a few other examples. I think you get the point. Now you see why I'm so much fun at parties. You know, when I'm asked to speak, people always say, gee, what do we do? If we put him before the meal, it'll ruin people's appetites. If we put him after the meal, it'll ruin their digestion. This is almost during a meal. I'm not sure what that will do. Perhaps I don't want to know. Let me close with one of the things that is discussed in bioethics, and that is there a duty to die? Is there a duty to die? And this was the title of the piece, Is There a Duty to Die? It was published in the Hastings Center Report in 1997. The Hastings Center Report is the most prestigious bioethical journal in the world. There's no question. And a fellow named Hardwick, bioethicist, wrote, a duty to die is more likely when continuing to live will impose significant burdens, emotional burdens, extensive caregiving, destruction of life plans, and yes, financial hardship on your family and loved ones. This is the fundamental insight underlying a duty to die. Remember when I started the speech saying, what is the purpose of society? The purpose of society is eliminating suffering. This is what happens when you accept that purpose, a duty to die, because to eliminate the suffering caused by family, caused by society, you have to eliminate the sufferer. He goes on, a duty to die becomes greater as you grow older. As we age, we will be giving up less by giving up our lives. If only because we will sacrifice fewer remaining years of life and a smaller portion of our life plans. After all, it's not as if we would be immortal and live forever if we could just manage to avoid a duty to die. To have reached the age of, say, 75 or 80 years without being ready to die is itself a moral failing, the sign of a life out of touch with basic realities. Here's a basic reality. My mother's 97. She's about 4'6". I call her a munchkin. If I said, hey, Ma, you have a duty to die because I'm an only child, and she sold her house in L.A. to be moved near me, and all that money's in the bank. But that's not nothing to do with it. Ma, you have a duty to die. I'd have the duty to die. Remember that old commercial, The White Tornado? No. I want to live. So I'll stop here because I'm out of time and because I think the point has been made. And I think we're ready for a weekend convention in which you are going to learn about a particular life view, one that is disparaged widely in the establishment media and in bioethics. But if you weren't willing not to be liked, you wouldn't be here. So learn, be ready to show contrasting worldviews, and when you're out there talking to people, remember, they don't necessarily have the same values as you, and when you come across that, just say, okay, here's where your values lead, and here's where my values lead. You're going to have to choose. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Wesley Smith, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism.